We're very glad to be here with you during these days. And what we're going to be looking at is the book of Kings. You know, many times I think people tend to view these stories as just, well, yes, I've heard those before, and we know all about those. But I believe that biblical narrative is very important, and because God has written it for us, that should be the first reason for believing it's important. But then in addition to that, we have accounts of things that happen to people and God's evaluation of those things. And since human nature hasn't changed and sin is still expressed and God's nature is holy and good, how he interacted with that and what he did and what the people responded with is the same kind of things that happens today. And so if we can learn what was going on truly during those days, even though it was thousands of years ago, we can learn how life works today and understand it better and understand God and his ways better. So biblical narrative is very important. And as we go through this, we can learn more about God and learn about ourselves and learn about the dangers that we face and learn about the needs that we have. So tonight, we're going to cover the first four chapters of 1 Kings. And I'm not going to read all these passages, but I'm going to assume that you have a Bible that you can glance at as we're going down through it. As we begin in 1 Kings chapter 1, this is where David is in his final years. It says that he was old, advanced in years, and they put covers on him, but he could not get warm. Therefore, his servant said to him, "Let a young woman, a virgin, be sought for our lord the king, and let her stand before the king, and let her care for him, and let her lie in your bosom, that our lord the king may be warm." So they sought for a lovely young woman throughout all the territory of Israel, and found Abishag the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The young woman was very lovely, and she cared for the king and served him, but the king did not know her. Now, chapter 1 actually shows the decadence of King David. It might seem a little surprising, but this Abishag episode, he is physically very feeble and he can't stay warm, and he has become a follower instead of a leader. And so his servants give him some advice. They say, well, you know, bring a beautiful virgin in here and she can be there and keep you warm. Well, doesn't it raise a question in your mind? Where was Bathsheba? The other wives that he had may have died by this time, because he is elderly and it's not uncommon for a man in those circumstances that David was in to have wives younger than himself. Remember the 10 concubines that he had left to keep the house. Absalom had violated them. So we don't really know. Maybe he had other wives. I don't know about that. But certainly Bathsheba was still alive. And so that raises a little question in your mind. And then another is that he related to Abishag in a halfway manner. She was not fully as a wife, but clearly she was viewed as being part of the kingly harem because of Adonijah's later scheme to get the kingdom through Abishag in his request through Bathsheba. So Adonijah exalts himself in verses 5 through 27. And King David doesn't seem to notice what's going on. Now, Adonijah's arrogance is illustrated by several things. One is he exalted himself to be king. He wasn't waiting for God's appointment as if he were supposed to be king. For example, Saul didn't go grab the throne. Samuel came through the instruction by God and appointed him. And David, even though he knew he was to be king, did not rush the situation. He didn't grab the kingdom for himself. But this Adonijah publicly paraded the trappings of kingship, even though he was not king. He had a chariot and men to run before it. Now, there are reasons for this arrogance. It says that his father, namely David, had not rebuked him at any time by saying, "Why have you done so?" He was also very good-looking. His mother had borne him after Absalom. David apparently had never rebuked Adonijah in his whole life. And the Hebrew there literally would be more of this line, did not correct him from his days. In other words, from his earliest days. That's the first reason listed, and I think it's the most important one. Another reason he was arrogant probably was he was very handsome. Now, if you happen to be very beautiful or very handsome, just beware, because that can be dangerous. Because people naturally gravitate toward a very handsome person. And so you have an advantage that is not very deep. It's only skin deep. And then it may be that he was the oldest surviving son. If you turn to 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 2 to 5, you find a list of David's sons. And Amnon was the firstborn, and then Chileab, and then Absalom was next, and Adonijah was next. Amnon was killed by Absalom, and Absalom was killed after his rebellion, and nothing has heard more about Chileab. Maybe he was off the scene, but he doesn't seem to figure in the situation. And so it's very likely that Adonijah is the oldest surviving son. And so he may have felt like that is another reason why he's due to be king. Now, David never rebuked his son, Adonijah, and obviously he wasn't rebuking his current folly in parading himself as king. And that contradicts his promise to Bathsheba. Because remember, David promised Bathsheba that her son Solomon would reign after him. And so what he does, he just let things go until events force him to take action. Adonijah has some co-conspirators. One of them is Joab. And Joab becoming a conspirator at this point helps explain Joab's life. Many times Joab did what was best for the kingdom, but it's very clear he didn't care too much about following God and really doing things God's way. And so he did the thing that was most expedient at the time for the advancement of his personal agenda, even if that meant coinciding with certain things God wanted done. By the way, that's a familiar tune too, isn't it? There are many people who do that same thing today. And then Abiathar the priest was also part of the conspiracy, and David was apparently unaware of the kingdom danger, as you see in verses 9 to 11. David's circle is not invited. All the sons of David were invited except Solomon. Now that suggests very clearly that Adonijah knew that Solomon was supposed to be the next king, and likely he invited the brothers so they could relinquish any claim to the throne. In other words, we have the big meeting and we have a big installation as king, and so their presence there would imply that they were saying he can be king. And Nathan is the one who provides leadership in this situation. And so he tells Bathsheba what to do to start getting the ball rolling in the right place. So in verses 28 through 53, this promise to Bathsheba is belatedly getting fulfilled. And it would not have happened unless Nathan had come in and dealt with it. And you can see that the disaster was just barely averted, verse 41, and then Adonijah's guests fled. Well, they realized, look, we don't want to be found with the conspirator here. We don't want to be connected with that. Let's get out of here. And so when Solomon was dealing with Adonijah, he was generous, verse 52. He said, if you're a worthy man, then you'll be safe, in essence. And worthy man would mean renounce all claims to the throne. Now, likely, Adonijah expected to be executed as a rival, which is probably what he would have done if he had had the chance. Chapter 2. What David does that also shows his decadence as king is that he pushes unfinished business off onto Solomon. Verses 1 to 9. Now, the first part is a good reminder. David reminds Solomon, and he says, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn, that the Lord may fulfill his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons take heed to their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, he said, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. And then he leaves Solomon with the charge to deal with the unfinished business that he hadn't dealt with. And the first one, he says that you need to execute Joab, verses 5 and 6. Now, Joab's character in general was he was loyal to King David, and he often did what was best for the kingdom. He was even spiritual in his insight in opposing David when David wanted to have the census taken that God was displeased with. But he forced David's hand when he assassinated Abner and Amasa, and he disobeyed the explicit instructions not to kill Absalom. Joab repeatedly used situations to advance his own agenda. He viewed Abner as a threat to his own personal empire, and so when the opportunity arose, he killed him. And he didn't like it that Amasa was made commander general, and so he killed him. Joab was a man you didn't mess with. And David didn't deal with it. Joab has demonstrated public support of the rival to young Solomon on the throne. Obviously, Solomon would have been considerably younger than what Adonijah would have been. And this shows he will stoop to any ends to achieve his own agenda. And so he's dangerous as a traitor. When David talks about this, he refers to Joab's treachery. Now, you could say, certainly David should have dealt with this himself. It makes us wonder a little bit about his own relationship to Uriah the Hittite. That was certainly treacherous. David talks about Joab killing people for insufficient reason, if you want to call it that. Well, certainly that was true with how David dealt with Uriah. And so maybe David was too embarrassed to deal with it. You could make all those kind of statements, but one thing is different about Joab and David, and that is we know that David repented of his sin with Bathsheba and of his sin with having Uriah killed. Another thing that David does, verse 7, is he asks for kindness to the sons of Barzillai. Now, certainly it was appropriate for kindness to continue to that family because of how they had treated David when he was in extremity fleeing from Absalom. However, it seems inappropriate to have Solomon put these people on the public dole just because of their kindness and loyalty to the previous king. I mean, if you gave them an assignment that said, here's a job that I want you to do because you've shown these qualities and it would be good to use them in the kingdom and continue that, that would be a different thing. But to just put them on the bankroll seems questionable. And then, verses 8 and 9, David tells Solomon to execute Shimei in a wise way. Now, what's going on there? To understand what's going on, we need to look back at 2 Samuel 16, verses 5 to 8. This is when David is fleeing away from Absalom. It says, when King David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. Coming from there, he came out cursing continuously as he came, and he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. Also Shimei said thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned, and the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom your son. So now you are caught in your own evil, because you are a bloodthirsty man. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please let me go over there and take off his head. But the king said, what do I have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. Who then shall say, why have you done so? And then he goes on talking about how that he was going to let him curse. And then Verse 13, as David and his men went along the road, Shimei went along the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went, threw stones at him, and kicked up dust. Now, it was against the law to curse the ruler of God's people. You can read about that in 2 Samuel 16, verses 9 to 16, and compare Exodus 22, verse 28. And now, David is telling Solomon to deal with Shimei. In fact, David actually swore by God not to have Shimei executed, and now he's telling Solomon to use wisdom to make sure he's killed. And one of the questions you can ask is, why was David so pitiful at his old age? I think part of the answer is this. David's sin with Bathsheba and the murder of her husband was the watershed in David's life. Before that time, he behaved very wisely. He made good decisions. And then after that point, even though he was forgiven, he made many bad decisions and many administrative decisions that were bad. He was under lots of pressure. He had lots of grave difficulties. There was Absalom and Amnon and civil war and so on. And there were things that David was responsible to do as chief executive of God's law, and he refused to do them. But nevertheless, even though he had committed that great sin, he did repent. God forgave him, that's clear. And then he kept growing after that, but he missed out on some of the blessings and insights that he could have had if he had been walking with God the whole time. In fact, David's influence for good actually continued through the centuries. He was the standard of good for succeeding kings. And the author of Kings says that David faithfully walked with God except for the case of Uriah the Hittite, 1 Kings 15:5. In a sense, David, in essence, defended Jerusalem for centuries because God spared it for his sake. And you can read about it in 2 Kings 20, verse 6. But what this does illustrate is the utter folly of saying, well, I know I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do it anyway, and then I'll ask God to forgive me. Because you see much disaster in David's life, not only in terms of the sword will never depart from your house, like God said, and you did this secretly, but I'll have it done in the sun, but also because David lacked insight to make right decisions, and he also succumbed to pressures to make wrong decisions that he would not have had if he had been walking with God faithfully the whole time. That brings us to chapter 2, verse 10. And in this part, Solomon's kingdom is firmly established. So in verse 10 through 12, David dies and Solomon sat on his throne in his place. Verse 13. Adonijah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, and he wanted to make a deal. He wanted her to do something for him. And he said, verse 15, you know that the kingdom was mine, and all Israel had set their expectations on me that I should reign. However, the kingdom has been turned over and has become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. Now listen to that pious-sounding thing. He came sneaking into Bathsheba in order to get Abishag. In other words, he still thinks the kingdom belongs to him, or did belong to him, yet refers to it being changed to Solomon because of the Lord. I mean, that was a pious-sounding cloak for a scheme he had to get the kingdom back. Now, why do we say that? Because getting Abishag would give him claim to the kingdom. You remember, God had said that he had given David Saul's wives into thy bosom, 2 Samuel 12:8. Now, remember, by that time, Saul was dead. And so it was practice in those countries for the incoming king to take over the concubines of the preceding king, and that was part of how you assumed the kingship. Absalom publicly went into David's concubines as an assertion of his becoming king, 2 Samuel 16, verses 21 and 22. And so Abishag is trying to sort of weasel in here and get some connection to this woman that was connected to David so that he could somehow get into the kingship. And Solomon shows his wisdom here. And also Bathsheba as the queen of the harem, you know, David's harem, he had quite a few women. She knew how to expose Adonijah's treachery. And so she comes in and says, here's what's happening. Will you grant this request? And Solomon realizes right away what the deal is. Adonijah is still scheming for the kingdom. And so he orders him to be executed. You see, Adonijah the schemer dies for his own foolishness, and Solomon has been one who is wisely following the advice of wise people. He actually becomes king. Verses 26 to 27, he removes Abiathar, the priest, that was a co-conspirator along with Joab, right on the heels of getting rid of Adonijah. And then in verse 28 to 35, he executes Joab and replaces him with Benaiah. And he replaced Abiathar with Zadok the priest in verse 35. Then you get down into verses 36 through 46, and he deals with Shimei. He calls him in and places him under a curfew and gets him to agree that he would not go anywhere out of Jerusalem, verse 36. He couldn't cross the Kidron. You might wonder about that. But I think the idea there would be so he would not be able to confer with his Benjamite brethren and stir up trouble. And Shimei agreed it was good. Well, after some time, a couple of Shimei's slaves ran away. And so Shimei went to Gath to get them. He left Jerusalem. So he broke his promise, verse 38, to the king. And so David's old curser has brought a curse on himself, and Solomon has him executed. And at the confrontation, Solomon reminds Shimei of all the wickedness he did to David. Now notice, Solomon had a hard job. David had left him with lots of complicated messes to straighten out. I mean, Joab was a very powerful man. I mean, he was a famous warrior and very talented as a warrior. He would have had lots of powerful friends. He was the head of a successful army, and he made his execution as difficult as possible for Solomon. And Adonijah had a strong faction of influential people, and David's refusal to deal with him properly as a parent and properly as nipping his kingly aspirations in the bud left a complicated and dangerous mess for Solomon. And obviously, Shimei would have had sympathizers among the Benjamites. By the way, the accusation that Shimei made when he was cursing David really wasn't true. It was true in one sense. David was a bloody man, but not the way Shimei said. David was a bloody man because he murdered Uriah the Hittite with the sword of the children of Ammon. But he was not a bloody man in that he came and destroyed the house of Saul. And so Shimei would have had sympathizers, and that you have another complication. So at the very beginning of his reign, Solomon has to deal with some very difficult, messy things that David left for him to deal with. That brings us to chapter 3 and 4. And these chapters focus on Solomon's reign of wisdom. The first two chapters show Solomon getting established in his kingdom, and these two chapters show Solomon's reign of wisdom. Now, at the very beginning of this chapter, you see a little taste of some flaws in Solomon's character. Now, Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall all around Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Now notice a flaw in terms of his personal affairs. He had a political marriage to Pharaoh's daughter. And we should note that before he ascended the throne, he had already married Naamah the Ammonitess, who had borne him Rehoboam. How do we know that? When we look at 1 Kings 14:21, and compare chapter 11, verse 42 and 43, you find out that Rehoboam was a certain age when he ascended the throne. And so you know that Rehoboam was born before Solomon ascended the throne. And so that's his firstborn. Why David had his son marry an Ammonitess, the scripture doesn't say. But certainly it is not a kind of thing that someone who's really seeking after God would have done, it would seem. And certainly not a scheme for the best example. Anyway, marriage to an Egyptian was not specifically forbidden in the Mosaic law, but marrying Canaanites was forbidden. It was permissible to marry a woman taken in war, according to Deuteronomy 21, verse 10 and following, but only if she renounced idolatry and followed the Lord would such marriage be within the spirit of the law. And it seems like, possibly it was the case, that Pharaoh's daughter would have renounced idolatry because it's unlikely that Solomon's early faithfulness would have condoned idolatry in Jerusalem. There is no trace of idolatry of Egyptian type during Solomon's era. And in chapter 11, when it talks about his heart being turned away, there is no mention of Egyptian idolatry. In fact, she is especially distinguished from the other foreign wives who turned his heart away. So the question is, why would David help him arrange a marriage with an Ammonitess? That's an unanswered question. But we do know that this marriage to Pharaoh's daughter was a political marriage. Literally in Hebrew, chapter 3, verse 1, it says that he became Pharaoh's son-in-law. In other words, it's stressing the relationship to the father, not the relationship to the woman. So you can see it was clearly a political marriage. You might wonder why this happened. Well, it shows the importance of the Davidic kingdom at this time and the weakness of Egypt. I mean, the former pharaohs refused to give daughters even to important kings. And this pharaoh gave his daughter and also Gezer for a wedding gift, according to 1 Kings 9:16. So Pharaoh got some trade routes and Solomon got a secure border on the south. But you know, when a king makes a political marriage, it certainly suggests a trust in human schemes rather than the Lord. So you see, you have a little hint here of a couple things that aren't quite like they ought to be. And I think that is important for us because sometimes it's easy to think, well, this shouldn't matter too much. It's a little thing. And yet you see the stage getting set for much bigger things. And then in verses 2 to 3, you have a flaw regarding religious affairs. Both he and the people sacrificed on the high places. The temple wasn't built yet. Now, this is not for worship of other deities, but it's for worship of the Lord at other places than one central place. It's still contrary to the law. And the wording here indicates that this was an issue that needed correction. And God's prophets often spoke against this. You see, it was a detraction from God's ordained type worship at the central sanctuary. And so then, since you have these other spots where you can go do your worshiping, it would be more of a temptation to add in a few other gods just to get some extra advantage. Now, there is some historical background for this confusion. The tabernacle was at Shiloh, but when the Philistines captured the ark in Eli's day, that place lost its significance as the place where God met with his people. You can see the ark was gone. And for years, the returned ark remained in Abinadab's house, according to 1 Samuel 7, verse 1, until David moved it to Jerusalem. And then the tabernacle appears at a place called Nob, N-O-B, 1 Samuel 21, and was there until Saul murdered the priests, 1 Samuel 22. And then later it was moved to Gibeon and connected with the ministry of Zadok, according to 1 Chronicles 16, verses 39 to 40. So you can see things are just sort of shuffling around. And so during the reign of David, you actually have two tabernacles. There's one at Gibeon, and it has certain advantages. That one has the original tabernacle which Moses had made, according to 2 Chronicles 1, verse 3 to 5, and it has the bronze altar made by Bezalel, grandson of Hur, 2 Chronicles 1, 5. The problem of this place is that it doesn't have the ark. Then in Jerusalem, there is a tabernacle that David had erected. It's not the original. And you can read about that in 2 Samuel 6, verse 17, and 2 Chronicles 1, 4. But this tabernacle, although it's not original, it does have the ark. So the one was without the original tabernacle, the one was with the ark. And so now you see people are going to be divided into which one is best to go to. Now notice what's going on here. Wrong actions many years earlier have bad continuing effects. Eli failed in his family, and his failure in the family institutionalized more failure in his sons. And then the ark, when returned, was not placed in the Mosaic tabernacle. And David used the Philistine method for returning the ark, and somebody got killed in the process because they touched the ark. Finally, God said, that's enough. And then you have two competing central worship places. Well, if you can have two, then why can't we have another one that's a little closer to us? You can see how those kind of things would happen. However, it does say something good about Solomon, that he followed the statutes of David his father, and the exception is sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. But then chapter 3 goes on with details about Solomon's wisdom. So the king, verse 4, went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask, what shall I give you? Now, the verb that's used here about Solomon used to offer is an imperfect verb, which would suggest that was his practice there, offering sacrifices. And God met him at the high place of Gibeon. Now remember, Gibeon was the place where the Mosaic tabernacle was and the bronze altar made by Bezalel, the grandson of Hur. And Solomon said, I am but a little child. Now, according to one commentary, apparently he would have been about 20. And he requested wisdom. Now, that's a very desirable thing, very pleasing to God that he requested that. And literally, it would read like this. He said to God, give me a hearing heart. You see, that's what real wisdom is. A hearing heart. It's a heart that really hears what God has to say. Give me a hearing heart to judge your people. In other words, he was asking for the ability to really hear, in the sense of obviously obeying, not just hear it and say, oh, well, I didn't like that idea, I'm going to do something else. No, hear it in the sense of obey it, and be able to hear God's wisdom so he would be able to judge God's people, to evaluate the cases that come to his jurisdiction. In other words, his responsibility for deciding the case. He's not asking for philosophical wisdom. He's not asking for wisdom, understanding how the animals do their things, but he's asking for a hearing heart so he could judge God's people properly. And notice, he makes his request while he's dreaming. Now that shows where his heart really is. We tend to think, well, I had a dream, and maybe sometimes you have some very bad responses in the dream. And well, that was just a dream. But notice, Solomon made this good choice when he was having a dream. It shows where his heart was, and he replied marvelously in his dream. And so God made a promise. Verse 12, he said, I'm going to give you wisdom that surpasses everybody before you or after. In other words, God gave wisdom far beyond his request for skill in ruling. It was a comprehensive and vast understanding, which you can read about in the latter part of chapter 4. He was wiser than the famous sages. He wrote 3,000 proverbs and 1,005 songs. And he was recognized for his wisdom and sought for by people in foreign countries. And also God said, I'll give you riches and honor so none could compare with you during your lifetime. That's in verse 13. Now notice, this comparison is less extensive, which emphasizes God's priorities. In other words, he's saying wisdom is a lot more important than riches and honor. And that does correspond to the other things added if we seek first the kingdom of God. Remember, it's easy to be so concerned about things. What shall I eat? What shall I drink? What shall we wear? And God says to us, namely Jesus said, if you seek first the kingdom, God will handle these other things. And so you see, here is Solomon seeking first the ability to do the job that God has given to him. And God says, okay, I'm going to give you some other things also. But notice verse 14, it's conditional. It's if you walk in my ways like David. God is going to lengthen your days. Incidentally, that was not fulfilled. And we read about that in 1 Kings 11. Well, Solomon awoke, and it was a dream. So then he went to Jerusalem and offered there. Verse 15. Now you might say, why was that? Well, likely it was an act of thanks. But I think more likely it's confirmation of the conditional covenant that God had made with him. Because remember, God says, so if you walk in my ways, keep my statutes and my commandments, then I will lengthen your days. And so Solomon is in essence confirming, ratifying the covenant that God is making with him. And then Solomon's wisdom is demonstrated by a test. Two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. And one woman said, we dwell in the same house. I gave birth and she gave birth. And we were together. No one was with us except the two of us. This woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. She arose in the middle of the night, took my son from my side and traded sons. In the morning, I awoke to nurse my son, and there he was dead. And then I looked, and this wasn't my son. And the other woman said, no, the living one is my son, the dead one is yours. And the first one said, no, but the dead one is your son, the living one is mine. Now, what would you do about that? Notice there are no witnesses. There are two people making the same claim. The other one is lying, I'm telling the truth. They're both making opposite claims. And Solomon has deep insight into human nature. And he is able to uncover evidence immediately in the court. There's nothing that he has to look at, but he does something that uncovers evidence right there in the court that makes it crystal clear who is the liar and who is the truth teller. And then he boldly exposes that fraud and gives a just verdict. And so everybody's just like, wow. Just imagine. The result is the people feared the king. Why? He said, well, bring me a sword. Okay. Chop the baby in two. Give each of them half. And the one who was the real mother cared about the baby. So she said, oh, no, don't. Just give it to her. And the other one said, sure, that's a good idea. It'll be neither hers nor mine. And Solomon said, see, that's the mother. You know what this would do to crooks? If you were covering up something, you wouldn't want to go to Solomon for judgment because he had put his finger on something and you'd be exposed. You see what it said? In fact, in Hebrew, it would read like this. They feared from the face of the king. I mean, frauds and con men wouldn't want to risk it. So you see, the kingdom is really getting established in his hand, and people are realizing this king truly has wisdom. That brings us to chapter 4. Solomon is king over all Israel, and then it lists his officials, tells who they are. And then verse 7 through verse 18 and 19. He tells about the 12 governors over all Israel who provided food for the king and his household. Each one made provision for 1 month of the year. So you have 12 regions, and one person is responsible for each region to get the tax money, the tax revenues, however they were paid, either money or animals or whatever, to the king. And so after listing these major officials, then you go down through the list, and some of the tribes are represented. And then there are regions of this, and the tribal boundaries aren't necessarily followed. Some tribal boundaries would be, but others were not. In fact, it doesn't seem like Judah is represented here. In fact, that could be checked out some more. I need to think about that. But it almost seems like Judah is somewhat exempt. It doesn't mention any towns of Judah that I can see. And you have these regions are different now. Now, what's the significance of this? Notice they are collecting taxes to support the central government, and they're not always following tribal boundaries. This is a radical change. What it's doing is it's virtually abolishing the political significance of the tribal system, and it's a new heavy tax burden. So instead of 12 tribes supporting the central priesthood as God had directed, what are the 12 tribes supporting? Solomon's court. And this is going to have new costs. You've got the king, you've got a huge harem, you've got chariots and horses, you've got a standing army, and you've got a growing population to administrate. So lots and lots of costs. But as we go down through this chapter, we see that there is great prosperity in Israel. And there's actually a chiastic structure in this passage that I'm going to show you. One of the things that the biblical authors did over and over again was put things in chiastic form to make an emphasis. They'll say something and then say the companion thing further down. Then come down from the top, they'll say something, and then up from the bottom, they'll say a similar thing. It's like an envelope, and inside that's an envelope, and then maybe inside that's an envelope, and the center becomes a focal point. So notice here, verse 20, Judah and Israel were eating, drinking, and rejoicing. And then verse 25, Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree. That's a pair. Then come down from the top, verse 21, Solomon reigned over other kingdoms who brought tribute. And then up from the bottom, verse 24, Solomon reigned over other kingdoms without rebellion. Right in the middle, you have Solomon's provision of grain, verse 22, and Solomon's provision of meat, verse 23. Now what that does, it shows a focal point on the provisions that were used up by Solomon's court. Notice the emphasis here on the time of prosperity. There is tribute that is being taken. Countries under tribute would commonly rebel when the next king came on the scene. In other words, there was some kind of agreement. The new king comes on the scene, they'd rebel so that if he didn't enforce it, they'd be free from it. And so the new king would need to prove his ability to enforce the agreement. Now, Solomon didn't need to prove his ability because God gave him peace. And that gave him time to build and to administrate and to trade and to pursue wisdom. But you know what he did? He squandered his time. He married 1,000 women. Can you imagine that? That'd take a lot of time. And he multiplied horses, and he had a lust for gold. So those things consumed a lot of his time, which God provided him time to focus on wisdom, and it also gave him time to be a great testimony to other nations when they came in. And I'm not sure how much of that he did. This focal center of the extent of food that Solomon's court was using up is pretty amazing. Fine flour, 150 to 280 bushels per day. Coarse flour, 300 to 560 bushels per day. Now, that would amount to possibly 28,000 pounds of bread. So someone has said that'd be sufficient for 14,000 people. That would be each person getting 2 pounds of bread. That's a good bit of bread for a day. When you think about that, that's feeding a lot of people. And then in addition to that, they had meat. Now, how much beef would that be? Well, a modern beef has 500 pounds per carcass of meat. Well, let's just assume these only had 300 pounds. Maybe they were smaller oxen. So 30 oxen would be 9,000 pounds. And then you had other meat, 100 sheep, wild animals, fattened birds. So it's certainly not unreasonable to figure 10 to 15,000 pounds of meat. And so the estimates of how many people will be fed would be somewhere between 14,000 and 32,000 people every day. Now, just imagine what kind of burden this is. And then, of course, verses 26 to 28, you've got provision for horses. And then verses 29 to 34, you have the author of Kings talking about supernatural wisdom. God kept his promise. God gave him wonderful wisdom, even though Solomon was already abusing his privileges. He was living extravagantly, and he was forcing Israelites to do things. You know, as the monarchy progressed from Saul to David to Solomon, there are more and more excesses. I mean, Saul was with the herd between his military campaigns. And then David had a king's house, 2 Samuel 11, verse 2, and he also had some forced labor. When you get down to verse 29, you find something about Solomon's wisdom. It says, God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. And then the following verses show wisdom on many subjects. It says, thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Machol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Also he spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Now, when it talks about songs, we have a Song of Solomon in our Bible, and we have that he is mentioned as the author of two psalms in Scripture that we know of, Psalm 72 and Psalm 127. Now, what are the possible impressions we get from reading chapters 3 and 4? The positive is good regarding the fulfillment of promise to Abraham and David, and there's a negative thing too, uneasiness regarding the warnings against wealthy kings by Moses and Samuel. It's interesting to compare Solomon's activities with Jeremiah 22, verse 13 to 17. Woe to the man whose enjoyments are based on the neighbor's service for nothing. Solomon was king, and so he could just say, go do that. Well, what if somebody wanted to stay with their family? Too bad. So what do we conclude from chapters 1 to 4? These early chapters in 1 Kings show how things that may not have seemed too serious in themselves set the stage for long-term disasters in the years that followed. What these chapters should help us see is, beware of saying, I like what God says, but I'll make a few modifications, just a little bit. Because you have no idea the extent of disaster you are setting in motion by taking that choice. And Solomon had more wisdom provided by God than any of us can expect to have. And he might have thought, I can handle it by making these modifications. But as we further go in the account, we'll find that he couldn't handle it.